Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is choreographer, writer, and director Jane Comfort. Comfort began creating her own interdisciplinary work in the late 1970s and has since created more than 45 original dance theater works for her own dance troupe, Jane Comfort and Company. In addition to her company work, she also choreographs for theater and opera and has worked with such luminaries as Stephen Sondheim and Michel Legrand. In 2010, she was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. And I'm speaking to Jane Comfort by phone from her studio in New York. Jane Comfort, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now you started out as a painter, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that and how you ended up segueing into such an intense interest in dance.
Well, I think it happened my senior year in college. Merce Cunningham came to perform. I'd always danced, so it wasn't like I was untrained. In fact, I took his master class when they were there, and I even volunteered to iron their costumes. But and I was so shocked at the costumes because there were these ratty sweaters with holes in them that I was convinced that these were not the costumes, and I went out to the stage to ask somebody if, in fact, there were other costumes. And they were all so intensely rehearsing that I just sort of crept back in the dressing room and kept ironing, and lo and behold, that night, there they were wearing them. But I saw Merce do such an amazing performance in a piece called Place, in which he was sort of encased in a plastic tube and falling out of the tube as if he were being strangled or being eaten by it, falling across the stage right. And it just sent chills down my spine. And at that moment, I thought, I can do better on stage than I can alone in an art studio.
Wow.
With a blank piece of canvas.
Yeah, that's amazing to me that you had that vision that you could actually do this. You know?
I did.
Wow.
I mean, you know, and I never looked back.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously.
Although I didn't
realize,
not only would I thought, oh, I don't want to be in an art studio alone with a blank canvas. I would be a dancer, choreographer, alone in a dance studio without even a canvas. But I have become very collaborative in my way of working,
so I
got rid of that problem.
Well, I want to ask you about the fact that you did break new ground as a choreographer by, you know, you combined traditional movement with voices and text. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came upon this idea?
I mean, it certainly wasn't intentional. It's just when you first start working, you go into a studio and you try to figure out what you have to say. And I would say by my second concert, language was a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is being from the South, where oral tradition is very important. So I started writing, but I was doing automatic writing, and it was just blocks of language that didn't particularly make sense. What made sense to me was the rhythm of it. It's highly rhythmic. And I would just take different blocks and construct rhythms that I liked. And to me, that was the musical score of the piece. So that's what it was early on. And to the point that I really didn't know how to incorporate music, but finally I started bringing in drummers because, to me, the text was the melodic line, whether it made sense or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I, early on, decided to do a piece to American Sign Language.
Ah.
And I actually went to NYU Continuing Ed and learned American Sign Language and signed actually an edited piece from Gertrude Stein's Many, Many Women.
Mm.
That was my dance. It was a dance for hands. And then later sort of expanded out from there to my own kind of gesture and then, you know, just became more full-bodied. But language has always been there.
Yeah,
and it wasn't
until
much later that maybe I started dealing with linear narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say I've ever done a complete linear structure,
mm-hmm,
even
mm-hmm.
if I've done a play, like I have done Macbeth, and it's exploded or deconstructed. I've done The Glass Menagerie, but it's been deconstructed. It's never been a straight-through realistic narrative. But I do use language in prose rhythm now, as opposed to the early language.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, it makes sense to me. It totally makes sense to me because dance is supposed to be storytelling.
Well, not necessarily. I wouldn't say Merce wouldn't agree with that.
Really?
No.
I've always thought that
he, even though his works were so dramatic, he wouldn't tell the dancers anything. He always insisted it was what you saw.
Really?
The drama was in the movement. It was in the structure. It was not a story.
Wow. Because I always think
of it. It's not necessarily storytelling. It's more like an abstract painting, but it's like a kinetic painting.
Wow. Well, you know, a lot of your work also addresses politics and social issues. And I've talked to a lot of artists and painters, and a lot of them are torn about whether politics should enter art. Talk to us what you think about this.
Well, I'm an artist, so I get upset about something. It's really hard to keep it out of the work, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, often when I think something's so topical that it won't last more than a couple of years, it's amazing how it does last. Because some of these issues are just so cyclical, or they're so basic, you know. Like, frankly, I've always been fascinated by hypocrisy.
Ah.
And so it just seems to be there in politics all the time.
That's a universal, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's a universal story.
Well, you know, you just mentioned that your piece was called Faith Healing, and that was based on the Tennessee Williams Glass Menagerie. Tell us how that became your starting point for this piece, though.
Well, earlier I had done a piece called Deportment, and I often returned to the South and growing up in the South. And I had wanted to make with Deportment a piece about how girls are trained to be women. And I called this piece Deportment. And It has the two meanings that you might imagine. But before I knew it, it had encompassed race. It had become a piece about bigotry, actually. It had become a piece in how children in the South are taught the polite, it's an oxymoron, polite forms of bigotry. Mm. And it is true, because through social mores, we are all taught how to be. And in the South, there are just sort of these humorous ways of dealing with things that are accepted. And then they're not. And you have to know where the line is. Even though it's all bigotry, there's sort of a line that one community accepts.
Mm-hmm.
And so we basically constructed this piece where inch by inch it got worse and worse. It started out really funny. The audience is laughing. And it was basically how this young girl is taught racism, homophobia, and sexism. And it just gets more and more... It's funny, 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 and all of a sudden it's not funny at all. It's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience is shocked. And what happens is they start looking back and realizing that they've been digging down into this grave for like the first 50 minutes and laughing the whole way. So I took two scenes from The Glass Menagerie and dropped them into the piece. I have no idea why, really, but they ended up in there. And I asked Mark Dendy to play Amanda. And someone saw the piece. Mark was brilliant, brilliant as Amanda Wingfield, the mother, the matriarch,
mm-hmm.
and said, I want to produce you doing a full Glass Menagerie, but gender reversed. But in the meantime, Mabu Mines, this amazing experimental theater company in New York, had just done a gender reversed King Lear, so I didn't see anything that I'd be adding to the world mm-hmm. by doing this. So I did then think, how could I approach that play and add something? And I really ruminated on it for a long time, and finally decided that since it's a memory play and everyone in the play seems to have fantasies and longings and desires, that I would use fantasy. And certainly growing up, I certainly used fantasy as an escape mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided the fantasies and structure would be American movies, because Tom is always going to the movies. And so we insert into it all these fantasies that happen, so that they're lip-syncing scenes from the movies and things like that. And each one represents a longing of that character.
Mm, that sounds fascinating to me. When I think of The Glass Menagerie, I always think of the stage full of ghosts, too. You know,
well,
it's
ghosts
a haunting
became
play.
Movies.
Uh-huh. That's fascinating to me. But, Jane, before we do run out of time, I want to talk to you about your 2008 piece called An American Rendition. Because
uh-huh.
speaking of topical and something that never ends.
Yes, I mean, we really didn't. We thought, once Obama was elected, it would end.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to great efforts to get that piece produced before the election, because we felt that once the election happened, this piece would no longer be relevant, and how wrong we were.
Indeed.
Sadly.
Yeah. So this is reality TV meets torturers, in essence.
Well, sort of the message was, torture is going on all the time. It's going on as we speak right now on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And no one wants to know. All these articles are in the paper all the time. And once I started researching, I realized it was everywhere. And yet, no one was talking about it. And it was just so easy to... I mean, everyone was obsessed with American Idol. More
yes.
people voted for American Idol than they did for presidential elections.
Yes.
Mm. And I even remember talking to someone in the field about Extraordinary Rendition. And she said, oh, you can't write about this piece without putting a definition of extraordinary rendition, because nobody knows what that means. And I said, of course they do. It's in the paper every single day. And she said, no, it's not. I said, well, just read the Times over the next 2 days and tell me if you see it. And she wrote me back and said, oh, my God, it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't choose to see it. And I think we're just so lazy. And I really structured the piece using the channel changer as the structural device. so that there is a linear story of an American who is detained at an airport, flown to a site, and interrogated until it becomes torture. And that linear narrative is constantly interrupted with a channel changer and its reality shows. So it's things based on America's Next Top Model and American Idol and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden the dancers are singing or they're modeling clothes or whatever.
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece. I saw an excerpt from it online and I was absolutely fascinated by it. Do you go out of your way to try to shock people into understanding what's happening around them?
Or, no. But we had to shock
people. Sure, you have shocked people.
Our dramaturg at one point was watching a run through and we hadn't gotten to the point where it gets ugly for the detainee. And he said, now you have to go into some really uncomfortable rehearsals. You have to go down the rabbit hole and scare yourselves even when you rehearse. He said, it has to be terrifying. Do not try to depict torture because you can't, you know. It just has to be a terrifying theatrical experience.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like it was.
And also I had such wonderful support from Steve Miller, who did the set design, which is all the video work. And I said, it should just be like a really bad acid trip, you know, that's going on, and that it would spin, and it's just so upsetting. So it's really hard. It was really hard, of course, for Sean, who plays the detainee, Sean Donovan, and then Peter Shisholi, who's this sweet, wonderful Buddhist who had to play the interrogator torturer.
Mm, yeah. And don't you put quotes in the background of public figures?
We did take
statements?
Some text from Donald Rumsfeld's list of rules for interrogation of unlawful combatants.
Mm.
And it is just remarkable for the bureaucratic language.
Yeah.
Fear up, harsh.
Oh, it's
fear
amazing.
Fear down.
Do you think you'll try to do this again because it's still so topical?
You know, presenters are terrified of that piece. They were terrified of it. It was the first time I had to self-present in 30 years.
Really?
We produced it ourselves. I was so, you know, it got on a lot of best of 2008 lists, you know, best performances of 2008. It was an amazing piece. But I thank every one of the presenters who produced it. But they're like, torture? Forget it. And then we're trying to write a press release that is honest about what the piece is but doesn't scare people away. I mean, actually, what happened is exactly what the piece was about. People don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
They'd rather be entertained. And the fact is there's a huge amount of humor in the piece, too.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Comfort. She is a choreographer, writer, and director. Go ahead. Do you want to continue talking a little bit more about your production of American Rendition?
Oh, no, as I'm saying, I often try to use structure as metaphor for the piece. And I think that what ended up happening also was that presenters were so scared of this piece or afraid that it wouldn't be entertaining. And that's exactly what our piece was about. People are so not wanting to know about torture that they just turn on the television or just change the channel.
Mm-hmm. I'm one of those strange people who really loves art to turn into the grittiness and show me what's really happening in the world. So I would have loved to have seen the whole production.
Well, if we hadn't gone there, it would have been a failed piece, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we're toggling back and forth between this more and more horrifying story and these inane television shows.
Yeah.
And these people who want to win.
Such a great analogy between the two. Now I want to talk to you about, is this a piece that you're still working on right now called Beauty? Because
yes,
that sounds fascinating.
You know, we were working on it, but then we got a National Performance Network commission to restage Faith Healing, the Glass Menagerie piece.
Mm.
So, and that was supported by two NEA American Masterpieces grants. So the Joyce Theater produced it and has been touring. And so all of a sudden Faith Healing jumped in line ahead of Beauty, which we had started working on and had to put aside.
Oh.
Now we're working on it full blast because we're going to have our first performance of it this June at Jacob's Pillow in Massachusetts.
Well, tell us a little bit about it, because that's another, it's another narrative about what's happening in this culture.
Yeah, I don't know how I got on Beauty. After I came off Rendition, I gave myself a break, and I was sort of like, gee, I wonder what the next piece will be about. I sure didn't want it to be about torture. I mean, just that research is so difficult.
I'll bet.
And believe it or not, Barbie turned 50, and somehow, even though I never had a Barbie, it just kind of stuck in my head. I wasn't sure why, and it became, we called it Beauty, but I will say for years I've been saying that culturally this country, this idea of female beauty in this culture, our American culture, has gone more and more towards looking like Barbie.
Indeed, you're right.
With this, you know, the whole anorexic body, but these huge boobs and this big hair that's ironed or, you know, whatever, and you know, the stilettos, and it's just so, and the upkeep that it takes is just incredible.
Well, you know what I was thinking? It is another form of torture.
Well, it is. I mean, we wear shoes we can't walk in, we wear jeans we can't breathe in, and then we put Spanx underwear underneath it so we further can't breathe. And,
I know.
But if you look back at the 40s and the 50s, there's always been standards of beauties, but they were so much more simple, you know, like buffing your nails and some powder and lipstick. But now, if I went through the list, you know, just what you can do with your face, it's unbelievable.
So in this piece, you're depicting Barbie dolls as the symbols of this piece, right?
Well, we go in and out. They're Barbies, and then they are regular people. Are there characters? There are certain characters who have, like, one character has an eating disorder, and another one is addicted to plastic surgery. And then we get down to a level, I don't know if you want to say, where the dancers themselves, as they're performing, are asked questions using their name. Like, Ellie, did you ever have a permanent? Or just questions about their own beauty regimes. And so you kind of get to know layers of people. You know the Barbie person, you know the character they're portraying in the show, and then you learn about them. What do you like about your body the most? What would you change if you could change? And all the answers are different.
Wow.
Someone will say, my ass. Oh, I wish I were thinner. You know, I mean, we're all kind of in that. And at the end, there'll be a beauty contest.
Wow.
And there are certain people in the audience who will be the judges. And they vote on a queen.
That's going to be a really powerful piece, I think. Because
there's
a
lot of stuff that's come up. I mean, it's been really, because we've sent out little beauty questionnaires to each other and written things about growing up and having a body or, you know, feeling ugly. And when I grew up in the South, there was this term called don't be ugly. And what it meant really was don't be active, don't be ambitious, don't be angry.
Don't be assertive.
Don't be assertive. Don't be more male. Be female and passive. So one of the scenes I'm actually was just writing before we talked is about a woman CEO who is told by somebody from human resources that her body language is too harsh. It's like a bitch. And it's basically gender neutral, her body language. And he's trying to push her into a more feminine body language, which would mean that your weight would be shifted to one side. It wouldn't be shared by both legs. And you would torque your body away from the audience a little bit, and you would use your hand to talk and nod your head and smile, which is basically how I was taught to be a girl.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when you study acting, there are hierarchical body language classes, and it's like if you're a king or a queen, how you stand, and it's basically on both legs with your arms at your side. You never nod your head, and you can interrupt. And if you're a serf, you turn your body so that you're not presenting your whole body to the king. You use your hands, you nod your head, and you keep going, And it's really, unbelievably, it's male and female.
Yeah.
Even though it could be a queen, it's male. The powerful body language is male. And so I'm trying to work that into the piece with this little scene.
Oh, I'm glad you're doing this. Because, a lot of us who came from the resurgence of the feminist movement in the 70s wondered what happened to all of that, all of that organizing around women trying to be themselves and being allowed to be themselves. And it's totally lost now, it feels like.
It is. It's just amazing. Like, well, when you drop from the 70s to the 80s, it's almost like the whole wind went out of the movement with now and everything with the ERA. But there's a book I just saw online. I think it's called Female Chauvinist Pigs. You could Google it. And this woman is talking about the raunch culture of females right now. And so you've got this third wave of feminists, or they don't even call themselves feminists. And they're saying, I dress like this because I choose to, even though they look like professionals, right? But they're in these really, mini skirts up to their crotches and the whole bit, and tottering around in the stilettos.
God.
And they're saying, no, I am in power because I am choosing to. And she's really questioning, are you really choosing it, or has the culture chosen it for you?
Yeah.
Has a male gays chosen it for you?
That's the question. Now, I want to ask you this, a follow-up to this talk about beauty. You're the director of a dance troupe. How involved are you in the issue of dancers and eating disorders, which
that's part of the piece, too.
Heard about, yeah. But what about
I mean,
as
I have
the director?
Never worked with anybody that I know of who's had an eating disorder. Partially, I think dancers dance so hard all day long that they eat a lot.
Mm.
But I see people at the gym. It's really scary what they look like. But where I see it is models. You know, And one of the pieces, actually, we just cut this scene. I don't know if it'll end up in the piece or not. We had a food delivery, and everybody's eating, and this one Barbie was eating a napkin, which is actually a model practice, eating tissue.
I've heard that.
It expands in your stomach and makes you feel full.
Oh, I've heard that. I've heard about all those tricks that women use.
I
lived with a bulimic
horrifying.
Once. I know.
And laxatives.
I know. I lived with a woman who was bulimic once, and it was just horrifying to me. Yeah.
No, we're definitely dealing with that because we're going to Jacob's Pillow and also Bates Dance Festival next summer, and they have these young dancer programs. So the directors are really eager to have this brought out, and a lot of our workshops we do associated with the piece when we're in residency will be about that.
Yeah, because the dancers still, I mean, they feel an immense pressure to be thin, just like models. So.
Oh, yeah, especially ballerinas.
Yes. No. Yeah. Now, you know, I want to talk to you about the creative process as a choreographer. Tell us how you imagine a piece and bring it to life. Do you write down notes first, or do you get your dancers to start working it out in from your mind into the? To tell us how you go through the process.
Well, I'm highly collaborative. I really prefer it that way. I feel like everybody is going to be so much better in a scene if we built it together, but then I can be a dictator too, or say the editor. I think with the beauty thing, I asked two of the dancers to come in and brainstorm with me, and I just told them all my thoughts about it, and then we sort of brainstormed about how we could present it. I did have this idea of the beauty contest. So I come up with these various scenes, and say if there's a scene with the dancing in it, we all actually spread out across the studio and work on our own on steps, and then we sort of teach each other, and then I kind of look at it and figure out ways to put it together. So it's kind of coming out of all of us. I tend to write the script.
That's what I was wondering,
The scripts. And then one of the things I did last week was I wrote every scene of this. Because at one point I said, you know what, instead of the way we did it in rendition, where we followed the story through as we rehearsed it and made it, I said, I'm just going to make scenes, and I don't know where they're going to go. I know the gist of the story, and we'll find out. So then I put them all on each on a little index card, and just in rehearsal laid them out. Last week we had like an hour just talking about scenes, taking some away. And it's a tough process because people get attached to things, and people start thinking their idea is great. And then, you know, in the end I might just say, well, I want to do it this way, or, you know, I just say, let's try this.
Mm-hmm.
So we're having a little showing tomorrow for our lighting designer, our costume designer, and our dramaturg. And we're trying one version where there's going to be less Barbie, and we'll see how that works. I actually don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I have all the scenes out, and we just keep going up to the front of the room and referring to them. And sometimes we'll put them together and go, God, how can we make this transition? It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And with that impossibility, you come up with something that really surprises you.
Yeah. Do you end up, as you say, scripts in stone, or is there
no,
still room for improv?
No, you were calling. I was rewriting a script I'd written where the guy is getting the corporate person to change her body language.
Mm-hmm.
I had written it last week. We rehearsed it last Friday, and as we rehearsed it, we found what I would say in the mouth. As you're doing it live, there were things that felt better. And then there were certain things they would do that I thought made more sense. And so I just kept scratching up the script, and we kept changing it and trying it. And I was just rewriting it on the computer when you called.
Hmm.
And we'll see how that, you know, if that's going to work. I don't believe in free, you know, I have worked on a couple of Broadway shows, and they always use that term, is it frozen yet? And I'm like, what a term. I don't think I freeze my pieces.
Okay, so I was wondering about that, because I noticed on your website you have these little notes in the background with little stick figures.
Those are early
directions.
Notes, very early, but I still do that. I did that, you know, I was working on one section in this piece, and I was working at home, and the best way for me to remember stuff is just make these little stick figures so mm-hmm. I can remember.
I thought that was fascinating. I was wondering if that's the way choreographers write.
I don't know how people do it.
Well, I wanted to know how you do it.
Yeah, some people, you know, will improvise and videotape themselves. Other people will improvise and have their dancers right behind them, and there are certain dancers who are really good at picking it up instantly, and they'll turn around and say, "What did I do?" And the dancer will show them.
Hmm. Now, do you have people compose original music for most of your pieces? How important
yes,
is the music?
Yes, we do, and I hardly ever make up anything to a piece of music. That's probably, you know, one of the gifts of working with Merce. And we're working with a sound designer this time, Brandon Wolcott. I think he's so smart. I really am looking forward to working with him. So, you know, he'll see these scenes, and he'll get some ideas and send me music, and then we'll go back and forth.
Hmm. So that's almost like a film. Because usually the music is put into a film after the film is complete, correct?
Yeah. I did a commission with Ballet Memphis last year. I've been working with them for the last 3 years, but last year, and Kirk Whalum was going to do the music, and he's a jazz musician. He's played saxophone for Whitney Houston for years.
Mm.
And he's so busy. And I had a feeling when we met that I wouldn't see that music until the week of the show. And I just started making the piece. I didn't need the music. I was making my piece. The piece really didn't have steps, but the dancers are so smart. Those are such great dancers. They just have such a tight sense of timing. And Ballet Memphis was going crazy. They're like, "Where's the music? How are you going to make the piece?" And I said, "We're making it." And they said, "But how can you?" They were like, "I don't, what's going to happen? This is going to be a disaster." And a week before the show, we got the music, and, you know, it was great.
I was just wondering, do you think of yourself as a teacher as well as a choreographer when you're working with your dance troupe? How do you?
No. Well, you know, it is my idea that we're working on, but then I feel like we're all in there stirring the pot together and working and talking, and, you know, everybody's throwing out ideas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I remember once years ago, because the way I do this is I form things as questions. Mm-hmm. I'll say things like, "Gee, I don't know if we should end this all standing here with the lights going. I don't know if that's the right way, or I should make an exit." And new people, you know, it's really an invitation for everybody who wants to say something to say something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, "Well, what if we did blah, blah, blah?" But I've seen sometimes when new people look at me like, "What does she want? What does she want?" And I heard someone once say, "This is how she works. Just get used to it." But it's just an invitation, and you don't have to respond, because sometimes I just think out loud.
Yeah, well, that's part of your philosophy of collaborating, I would assume.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jane, we only have about a minute and a half left. I want to ask you one final question. Do you think you have an eye of a painter still that helps you as a choreographer?
I may. People have told me that, but I'm not aware of it when I'm working.
So you don't feel
sometimes
the connection.
I do have a visual picture, but, you know, I don't know.
It's a different process. Well,
I would leave that up to the audience.
Can you give some contact information for your website and so on, so people can get in touch if they
My
can.
Website is janecomfortandcompany.org. Everything's spelled out.
And it's a wonderful website.
And, it, you know, it is a new website. Well, new as of a couple of years now. But it has quite a lot of archival material on it, and it has some oral stories from the past, and all kinds of things. It's fun to dig around in.
Yeah. Well, Jane Comfort, we have run out of time here, and I thank you so much for joining us, and keep up your amazing work.
I think you're
doing such great stuff for the culture. I really like that you've made all these horrible things and ugly and horrifying world events into art.
Thank you so much. Well, you know what? Faulkner is one of my great favorite writers.
That makes sense. Somebody from the South.
Thank you so much, Tish.
Thank you, Jane Comfort. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.